Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting. The White House says President Donald Trump has a buffet of options on how to get Mexico to pay for the wall he wants to build along the U.S.-Mexico border. Plans for the controversial wall have soured Mexican relations with the U.S. just days into the Trump presidency.
Unless Mexico is going to treat the United States fairly, with respect, such a meeting would be fruitless, and I want to go a different route. We have no choice.
Earlier Thursday, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto canceled next week's meeting in Washington after Trump said the talks should be called off if Mexico keeps insisting it will not pay for the wall. British Prime Minister Theresa May's meeting at the White House on Friday will be Donald Trump's first with a foreign leader as president, and May wants to use it to bolster the transatlantic relationship.
It has been America's destiny to bear the leadership of the free world and to carry that heavy responsibility on its shoulders. But my country, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, has been proud to share that burden and to walk alongside you at every stage.
But she's under fire for cozying up to a president who's renewed his commitment to building that Mexican border wall and moving to pull the U.S. out of international trade treaties. While Wall Street celebrates yet another stock market record, many Americans have little reason to cheer. The wealthiest 10% of households own roughly 80% of stock market wealth. The Dow's 23% surge over the past year has benefited mostly investors who were already well off. This is VOA. Volkswagen's efforts to do right by owners who unknowingly purchased cars and SUVs that cheat on emissions tests have run into some speed bumps. Owners say the company isn't delivering on a promise to quickly buy back their vehicles. Some complain about multiple requests for paperwork, even after being told their application was complete. The German automaker acknowledges some hiccups, but blames delays on an overwhelming volume of buyback requests. A company lawyer told the judge handling the VW case that almost 400,000 owners had applied to have their vehicles repurchased in the 3 months since a legal settlement was approved. The Trump presidency is less than a week old, but congressional and executive actions have already revived the long-running national debate on abortion. And with two major marches in just 6 days, supporters on both sides show no signs of backing down. VOA's Catherine Gibson reports on the debate from Washington.
Anti-abortion supporters have rallied for 43 years to protest the passage of the landmark Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion. But as they rally this year, there's new hope for their cause. In one of his first acts in the Oval Office, President Trump signed an executive order preventing U.S. funding from going to any foreign organizations that promote abortion. The so-called Mexico City policy has always flipped, according to who is in the White House. Next up for House Republicans, a bill that would severely curtail Roe v. Wade, preventing any abortions after a doctor detects a heartbeat on an ultrasound. Catherine Gibson in Washington, VOA News.
Another attempt is underway that could establish California as a separate nation. A proposal has been submitted to state election officials that would ask voters to repeal part of the state constitution that declares California an inseparable part of the United States. If it qualifies for the ballot and is approved by voters, the proposal would be a step to a future vote on whether California should actually break away from the United States. Supporters Thursday were cleared to begin attempting to collect nearly 600,000 voter signatures needed to place the plan on the ballot. Similar attempts to make California a nation or break it into multiple states have failed. President Donald Trump is expected to ask the Pentagon for ways to accelerate the fight against Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria, and officials say the options probably would include steps the Obama administration considered but never acted on. I'm Lori London in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Gambians welcome their new president with jubilation.
Yeah, I have been here since 1 p.m., and as you can see, my vehicle is still stuck here. But I am still happy because it works.
One of the tens of thousands of Gambians who took to the streets yesterday to celebrate the return of their new president. Gambian exiles look forward to returning home. A spokesman says Nigerian President Buhari is well, contrary to news reports. The leader of Sudan's opposition Umar Party returns home, and African leaders prepare to choose the next chairperson at their summit this weekend.
It's a very important job. The chairperson of the commission has to really run the day-to-day workings of the commission in Addis Ababa. The chairperson really is the only pan-African position that we have.
Lou Van Drand is an analyst with the Institute of Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa, and striking Kenyan doctors have 5 days to end their strike. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tens of thousands of Gambians took to the streets yesterday to welcome their new president as Adama Barrow returned to the capital of Banjul. Cars filled with singing and dancing supporters accompanied Barrow as he left the airport escorted by Senegalese troops. Katerina Hoyer in Banjul compiled the sounds.
Yeah, it means we're going to have a better Gambia now. People are free, there's free, freedom of press to speak their minds and their voices.
Yeah, no, it will not happen because Barrow stands for the Gambia.
Yeah, I have been here since 1 p.m. and as you can see, my vehicle is still stuck here. But I am still happy because it works. Democracy is what we need. So I'm not in a haste at all. Even though I have been here since 1 p.m., I'm never in a haste. So I'm ready to be here, even it will mean until tomorrow morning. Because what we want, we have achieved that now.
Countless Gambian journalists, activists, and opposition members fled threats and intimidation during former President Yahya Jammeh's 2 decades in power. Now, as Jammeh begins his life in exile, some of them are going home. For VOA, Ricky Schreier traveled from Dakar to Banjul with one of them and has this report.
I'm on the Gambian soil for the first time in many years. It's unbelievable. It's surreal.
The last time Sheriff Bojang Jr. came home, 10 years ago, he was arrested at the airport by state intelligence agents and detained for questioning. This time, he was also recognized.
And then you can see out there the immigration people who stamped my passport, excited, thanking me for quote-unquote, you know, doing well to contribute to transition in the Gambia.
The border agents knew Bojang's name from his work as a radio journalist in West Africa.
Reporting for WADR, I'm Seri Bojang Jr. in Meliando in the forest region of Guinea.
And here he is covering the story of his life. We drive to the Gambia River and hop in a wooden boat to make our way to the capital, Banjul. There is no dock. The men from the boat seat us on their shoulders and carry us the few feet from the boat to Banjul's shore. Bojang hops down off the man's shoulders, first 1 foot and then the other, with a broad smile on his face. His phone has been buzzing with messages.
I said tears for you, tears of joy for you. I'm so happy for you, kiddo, and I know I love you dearly. Emotional, huh?
But these first hours back are disorienting.
I don't know. I'm sad now. My mood is changing every minute. 1 minute I'm excited, the next minute I'm upset. I feel like a stranger in my own home. I think it will take time before it sinks in.
Bojang still does not know why he was detained at the airport that day in April 2007. He thinks it was because he had taken part in anti-Jammeh protests in London, where he was studying. He had flown home to visit his dying father. When the security agents released him, they took his Gambian identity papers. Bojang quickly went to his hometown before heading to Dakar. It was the last time he saw his father. In Banjul, Sherif stops to buy a hashtag Gambia has decided t-shirt. The slogan was the rallying call for supporters of the new president, Adama Barrow. In a tremendous upset, Barrow won the December elections, beating Gambia's authoritarian leader of 22 years, Yahya Jammeh. But Jammeh wouldn't go. We waited at the border for days as Barrow was inaugurated on schedule, but at the Gambian embassy in Dakar. Senegalese troops rolled past us, ready to enter Gambia and remove Jammeh by force. And finally, after a final round of negotiations, Gambians watched as Jammeh boarded a plane to Guinea late in the night and flew off into exile. This was the man who had threatened to behead homosexuals, claimed he had a homemade cure for HIV, and was accused of ruthlessly clamping down on dissent. Activists are still demanding answers in the disappearances of at least two journalists detained by security agents and the unsolved murder of a third. Just last year, dozens of opposition members were detained. Two of their leaders were tortured to death in custody, according to their political party. Bojang became a vocal critic from Dakar, and he feared prison or worse if he returned to Jammeh's Gambia.
If I have to define a few years ago what it meant to be a Gambian, I would have said being Gambian meant being tolerant, being too tolerant and too peaceful that you would allow dictatorship to happen. Today, what it means to be a Gambian, as far as I'm concerned, is being determined, determination, courage, optimism, strength, fighting together through thick and thin to change the status quo.
On his first day back, Bojang made sure to take photos of himself around Banjul and post them on Facebook. He wanted other Gambian exiles to know it is safe to come home. Ricky Shryock for VOA News, Banjul.
A spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says the president is well and going about the business of doing the country's work. The 74-year-old Buhari went to London last week for routine medical checkups, the second such trip this year. But there were rumors in the press and on social media that he was seriously ill or even dead. But Lau Mohammed, Nigeria's Information and Culture Minister, says it is natural for the president to take a vacation. He accused those, he said, are circulating falsehoods to force the president to say he is not ill or even dead. Mohammed says the government will not succumb to blackmail.
Well, the truth is that a group of people are very, very mischievous. They've decided they're going to concoct a lot of falsehood and put pressure on the president to say, oh, I'm not ill or I'm not dead. And I would think it's just a distraction. But it's a very orchestrated and, you know, organized campaign. And I think one of the ways to distract government, the idea is to market government. But we do not think it's something we should waste our time on. I think it's perfectly natural for the president to take a vacation. And when he's on vacation, he doesn't have to show himself to anybody if he does not want to do so. And I think at very least, like taking a deserved rest, there's absolutely no truth in the fact that he's not well or that he's on life support. I think this is just the early work of some very sick people.
Like, what would you say to those Nigerians who want to know, why did the president go to London?
The president has the right to go anywhere in the world.
I know you said the president did not go for a medical trip, but what do you say to Nigerians who say when their officials, for some reason, they are not well, they should take treatment inside Nigeria, not to go abroad? This is not to say that the president went for medical treatment. I'm just saying generally, what do you say to that?
You see, the issue of health, I think, is a very personal issue. As long as I don't spend public fund going for medical health and there's no law that says that I must take medical care in Nigeria, I think it's a completely non-issue where a person, whether it's a private or public, you know, person decides to go and seek for medical assistance. I don't think that's the issue.
So you can assure Nigerians that the president is healthy, he's well?
Absolutely. But you see, what we will not do is that we will not succumb to blackmail. There's a president that's taking a well-deserved leave, is free and at full liberty to spend his leave where and how he wishes. The government is being run very smoothly. We had another council meeting yesterday, and there is just this busybody who have said that in 2017, all they are going to do is to ensure that they do not give Mr. President any British, you know, space. That's all. And we're going to handle them also.
This past weekend, I read a story that some people protesting in Port Harcourt against the election of U.S. President Donald Trump were arrested by your government. What is the truth?
Absolutely false. What is the business of the Nigerian government about anybody being pro or anti-Trump? Of what relevance is it to the Nigerian government? But you see, there's been a lot of campaign of calumny. They first started by saying that President Buhari donated $500 million to Hillary Clinton, and that the president was quite upset when Donald Trump won. I mean, it's baloney. Number one, where will we get $500 million to give to anybody now? And then, of course, they went back to link that with religious intolerance, saying that the Buhari government is anti-Christian. Absolute rubbish.
Lau Mohammed is Nigeria's Information and Culture Minister. He was speaking with me from Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 27th. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 and a half minutes past the hour. The leader of the Sudanese opposition Umar Party has offered to hold talks with President Omar al-Bashir's government to peacefully resolve existing tensions between the administration, political parties, and armed groups, according to Fadala Burman Nasir, deputy chairman of the Umar Party. His remark came after the chairman of the party, Sadiq al-Mahdi, who was twice a former Sudanese prime minister, returned to the capital, Khartoum, yesterday, Thursday, after about 2 years in exile. He went into exile shortly after he was released from detention. Nasir tells viewers Peter Clotty that the Umar party leader convinced the armed groups to lay down their weapons and engage the government through dialogue.
And I want to say that Mr. Sadiq al-Mahdi, the president of Umma Party, he left the country in August 2014, and he spent about 30 months outside his country. And now, today, he arrived, he came back home, and has been received by a big number of people from his own party and Sudanese, and this meeting it really is a national meeting representing all the Sudanese people, and he gave a comprehensive lecture concerning the time he was out and what he has achieved and what he sees now in Sudan and what is his plan to achieve in the future. All of them, they are convinced that they are all ready to go for negotiation and to solve the problem peacefully and to stop war.
Does that mean that the reasons why he left Sudan and went into exile, the threat being the main reason why he left, has been removed?
You see that he left the Sudan because they put him in jail because he said that some of the militias, those who are carrying arms by illegal ways, they are committed a lot of illegal crimes. And Sir Sadiq said that investigate with them and give the other people the rights. And for this reason, the government put him in jail. So he went outside and he sat together with them and he convinced them that through violence we cannot solve the Sudanese problem. Nothing to go for negotiation.
What are the prospects of the Umar party now that he has returned to lead the party ahead of the elections?
You see that now we are not talking about elections. We are talking, first of all, how to bring peace, how to make a settlement. And after that, then we talk about election. And the election must come after the interim period. Because if he go to election under this government, it will not be just election. We want election after an interim period, after a government formed from all the Sudanese people. But now we are not talking about election. We talk about solving the problem, and during the interim period, we make the commission of election, and the commission at the end of the interim period will run the election so as to have a just election.
What happens if the government rejects the proposal of the Mahdi?
We either have two options. We said it. If not, they are ready to cooperate with us to solve the problem peacefully, we will go to uprising.
Fadala Burma Nasir is the deputy chairman of the Sudanese opposition Umar Party. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from the capital, Khartoum. Five experienced diplomats are running for the top job at the African Union, and unlike previous years, this race has become very public. Heads of state will ultimately make their pick in private next week. Viewers Anita Powell looks at the slate of candidates, which features four foreign ministers and a UN envoy.
The victor of the five-way contest for the African Union's top job will be chosen by African heads of state next week at the AU summit in Addis Ababa. Current AU Commission Chairwoman Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma of South Africa took the job in 2012 and is on borrowed time after her four-year term was extended by 6 months after indecision about her successor. Analyst Lisa Lovadran of the Institute of Security Studies says it is not an easy job.
It's a very important job. The chairperson of the commission has to really run the day-to-day workings of the commission in Addis Ababa, formulate policy, carry it out. The chairperson really is the only pan-African position that we have.
A pan-African perspective will be a shift to the four foreign ministers running: Botswana's Pelomini Benson-Motoy, Chad's Moussa Faki Mahamat, Equatorial Guinea's Agapito Mbamukoi, and Kenya's Amina Mohamed. Analyst and Open Society advocate Jegan Gray Johnson points out the AU Commission chairperson must rise above borders and advocate for the entire continent.
The ideal candidate would be one that we know is relatively independent, hasn't been tainted by either their reputation that they've had and in previous positions, that has not been captured by the legacy of the loyalties that they might have had to their presidents when they were actually serving at their pleasure. And it would be good to maybe have a chairperson that for once would also stand up to the assembly in a reasonable manner.
The five candidates, which also include Senegal's Abdoulaye Batili, the UN Special Representative for Central Africa, appeared during a December debate at AU headquarters. Each spelled out priorities, including building peace and security, improving the situation of African youth and of women, increasing employment, finding a stable way to finance the AU, adjusting to climate change, and fighting the HIV epidemic and the African migration crisis. This was the first such AU debate, which Politics and International Studies Professor Cheryl Hendricks of the University of Johannesburg says is significant.
I think it's a very good thing for the people of Africa. Before, you know, nobody knew who the candidates were if you weren't part of the circle. We are all now following these various candidates. We're all commenting on them, even though what we say may not influence how heads of state vote. At least we are also having our say, and I think that is commendable.
Leaders are scheduled to pick the winner Monday. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A Kenyan judge has given striking doctors 5 more days to call off a nationwide work stoppage over compensation and other issues or risk going to jail. The ultimatum came as their supporters demonstrated outside a Nairobi courthouse. Jill Craig has more on the strike that has paralyzed the public health system.
Hundreds of doctors and their supporters marched Thursday to the Employment and Labor Relations Court in Nairobi, some waving Kenyan flags and others carrying signs saying it is actually the Ministry of Health that is on strike, not the doctors. They are protesting what they say is the government's refusal to abide by a 2013 collective bargaining agreement as the national doctors' strike nears its second month. Inside, Judge Helen Wasilowa announced she would be suspending the jail sentences of 7 medical union officials.
So I'll suspend this sentence further. So the doctors will not be going to jail today. They have 5 more days. And this 5 days is not for negotiation, in my view. It's for calling off the strike.
She added negotiations are permitted to continue during this period. Earlier this month, Judge Wasilowa sentenced the officials from Kenya's Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists, and Dentists Union to a suspended 1-month jail term for disobeying a court order to end their strike. They were given until January 26 to finalize negotiations with the government or face jail time. The union has argued the government used these pending jail sentences as a bargaining chip to delay negotiations. Protester Dr. Andrew Watende says this is unacceptable.
In this kind of engagement, one side is at disadvantage. One side has a sentence hanging over their head. The other side, there are no consequences. And so you can take your time. You can disappear for 5 days. Who will we negotiate with?
Union officials argue the 2013 collective bargaining agreement would increase their salaries by 180%. Last year, a judge ruled the agreement was unregistered. Kenya's government has responded with an offer of partial salary increases, but also threatened to fire all striking doctors. A request for response from Kenya's Ministry of Health and a government spokesperson went unanswered. Kenya's health system has been overwhelmed by the strike that began December 5th, with some estimates putting the number of resulting deaths in the dozens. The doctors are scheduled to return to court next Tuesday. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, James. We begin with the quarterfinal pairings of the Total CAF African Cup of Nations Gabon 2017, following the conclusion of matches in the group stage. On Saturday in Libreville, Togo Burkina Faso will face Tunisia in the first game. Patrick Malo, Burkina Faso defender, says they've got their eyes beyond the quarterfinals.
Our goal is not the quarterfinals. Our goal is the final.
Senegal and Cameroon will fight for a place in the semis in the other game in Franceville on Saturday. Remake of the 2012 final. Despite being dubbed favorite for the title, Aliou Cissé, the Senegal coach, is playing down their chances.
Cameroon have to be the favorites. Senegal have never won the AFCON. How many have Cameroon won? Four? So you see the favorites have to be Cameroon.
And then on Sunday, January 29th in Oyem, it will be DR Congo who will be facing Ghana in the early kickoff, and Ghana captain Asamoah Gyan, who risks being ruled out of the African Cup of Nations after suffering an injury in Wednesday's 1-0 defeat by Egypt, says DR Congo will be a tough side.
It's not going to be easy. We're playing against a tough side, DRC Congo. Very, very good team, you know. But as I said, we have to just focus on that game and go home, relax, and then go back to the drawing board, and then we see what happens.
In the later game, it will be a North African derby in Port Gentil as Egypt will face Morocco. Egypt head coach Hector Cooper says AFCON is a competition everybody wants to win, but that they will stay focused in order to brighten up their chances.
We're going to do everything we can to win, knowing that it's not easy and that our rivals are tough, but we have the same spirit as the people. This is football, and you've got to just play the games, knowing that all your rivals want to win as well. That's the competition.
And as the 2017 AFCON gets into the knockout phase, let's take a quick look at the statistics from the group stage. A total of 52 goals were scored, which averages 2.1 goals per match. Having scored 6 goals, DR Congo, Senegal and Tunisia are ranked as the best attacking teams. They are closely followed by Algeria with 5 goals, and then Burkina Faso, Morocco and Zimbabwe are grouped third with 4 goals each. Having scored 3 goals, Cameroon is ranked the 4th best attacking team, while Cote d'Ivoire, Egypt, Gabon, Ghana, Guinea-Bissau and Togo are ranked the 5th attacking teams, having scored 2 goals. On the scorer's chart, it will be Junior Kabananga of DR Congo with 3 goals who will be gunning for the Golden Boots, while Riyad Mahrez, Islam Slimani of Algeria, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang of Gabon, Sadio Mane of Senegal and Niamh Sliti of Tunisia all have 2 goals. That's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, January 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Barty in Washington.
Hello, I am your host, Shaka Sali. Every Wednesday night, the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, the 28th African Union Summit, voting for a new leader, discussing the re-entry of Morocco, and mapping the future of the continent. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.